Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Click promote and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Well, I do feel passionately, and my passion does match the passion of religious zealots and fundamentalists. However, there are different reasons for passion. I'm passionate about things because I've looked at the evidence, and the evidence is massively convincing. Religious zealots, fundamentalists, are passionate the other way, not because they've looked at evidence, but because they've looked at the Bible. I accept the charge of being passionate, but it's passionate for a very good reason. I've looked at the evidence.
That's Richard Dawkins, a famous new atheist. Of course, he's all over the place of late, criticizing religion in general, Christianity in particular, and he says he has good reasons. And of course, religious types, from his perspective, don't have good reasons, literally don't have good reasons. We have labored under the narrative of history, our latest history, that somehow we have been freed to think now freely and critically, when before we were shackled by an irrational faith, all of civilization. Is that way of talking about our history, the Enlightenment, true? We're going to answer that question in the next half hour of the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. David Bentley Hart joins us to talk about the new atheists. He's former professor of religion at Duke, the University of Virginia, and Providence College, author of the new book, Atheist Delusions: The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. Dr. Hart, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks. Hello.
Is this way of talking about our history, our intellectual history, that we've been freed from the shackles of irrational faith to now think as Enlightenment men true?
Well, no. Any account of history that's made in such broad brushstrokes is invariably true to only the most vacuous degree. When you listen to Richard Dawkins, for instance, you're listening to someone who certainly believes that he's engaged in a project of critical free inquiry, but his commitments are no less ideological and no less dogmatical than those of anyone else. They simply rest on different foundations from the people he despises. The little clip you played from Richard Dawkins, incidentally, let me interject something here at the beginning, is a good example, though, of the sort of straw man polemic that he tends to engage in, because, of course, he is talking about a certain very specific species of fundamentalism, and if you're going to set up your contrasts in such easy shades of black and white, then of course, rhetorically, you'll always come out on top. But it's at the end of the day, it's a rather childish picture of the distinction between what he's doing and what he imagines religious people are doing.
You talk about, early in your book, about what you call a potent and persuasive model of freedom. That is this, and later you'll call it an ethics of choice. What is it? And how should we critique it?
Well, it is simply enough. The modern concept of freedom, which, as you say, I say is potent and persuasive, and it's not self-evidently contemptible, but it does put the emphasis upon the act of choice itself as the index of a person's freedom. An older, a more antique understanding of freedom, which is Christian and Jewish and pagan and simply ancient, is the notion that freedom consists in liberating one's essential nature into its best end, into its proper end. The act of choice itself is not freedom. Choice is, at most, the possibility of the correct path. So, to be free is to come into that which fulfills our nature in harmony with the good. But the modern idea of freedom puts its emphasis more specifically on the individual's ability to choose regardless of the ends that he or she might choose. And as such, it radically reorients our sense of what it is that lends us human dignity or that makes our life admirable or worthy or worth pursuing. And it informs everything we are and everything we do. And my claim in the book is simply that this model of freedom, which is a dogmatical model of freedom, a particular metaphysics of the ethical act, underlies the sort of polemics that the new atheists engage in. It's a sort of doctrinal commitment to a certain understanding of what it is to be free, and that involves casting off the fetters of anything beyond ourselves that commands our assent before we spontaneously choose to give our assent.
But where will that inevitably lead? Where does that leave the person who tries to, I would say probably futilely, attempts to base their lives around this ethics of choice?
Well, I don't know where it inevitably leads. Where it evidently leads quite often is either towards a life of ceaseless triviality and sort of spiritual dispossession, but it can lead to far, far darker things as well, because when the emphasis is placed not upon the good towards which the will should be directed, but upon the will's power to craft itself, to create its own destiny and its own meaning, the paths that open up lead in directions that, as I say, at times are quite trivial and at other times quite terrible. The triumph of the will in the totalitarian politics of the 20th century is every bit as much an expression of this essential understanding of the human being liberated from the claim of God or the good or of nature, as is the sort of petty bourgeois consumerism that gives us Britney Spears or YouTube. So I don't know if there's an inevitable terminus. I just think that it's quite clear that this model of freedom leads in any number of directions we should either dread or at least deplore.
The caricature of popular history of the so-called kind of Christian era or Christian civilization of the past is that it wasn't much concerned with reason. It was concerned with what is kind of portrayed as its opposite, that is, faith. How would you correct that picture?
Well, first, you can only cling to that picture of the past if you scrupulously avoid knowledge of the past. It's a childish sort of finger paint daub of history. Anyone who's actually acquainted with the history of Christian thought knows that, sure, you find mindless catechetical fundamentalism of every stripe. You also find a vast and rich tradition of extraordinarily profound and careful thinking on matters of every sort. The very basis of the continental tradition of philosophy in the modern age, it all emanates from theological tradition and its interpretation of the past. Hermeneutics, ethics, metaphysics, or the abandonment of metaphysics, all of them still center upon the questions raised and examined throughout the centuries of the Christian intellectual tradition. And the reverse of that is that those who often proclaim themselves apostles of reason and therefore enemies of faith, when you actually examine the fundamental premises upon which they operate, prove to be every bit as fundamentalist and unreflective as the worst caricatures of religion that they can come up with.
With only a minute before we take a break here, I've been reading a book called Pulp Physics, and it's written by Dr. Richard Berenson. And he is narrating kind of the rise of technology, the rise of the physical sciences, all of these things. And again and again and again, what I hear from him is a theme that the church of the past suppressed, and stagnated intellectual inquiry until a few brave souls were able to kind of break these break through the bonds, or, you know, may have been burned at the stake or imprisoned or threatened with torture, but somehow the mind was freed. Is this an example of what you're talking about here, this kind of myth of the Enlightenment?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's pure mythology. That's what's so amusing about that is that if you go searching for the historical evidence for that, you come up with nothing except perhaps the Galileo affair. And even that, when you look into its details, turns out to be a fairly ambiguous story that it does credit to neither side of the debate. But no, it's absolute nonsense. And I'll say this, to their credit, the Guild of Serious Academic Historians, whether they are believers or unbelievers or not, do not talk that way. I mean, serious historians know that's nonsense. That's the sort of infantile polemics of you know, late 19th century, early 20th century humanism, and it's just silly.
We're talking with Dr. David Bentley Hart about the new atheists and much of the mythology that surrounds them, not so much the history that they would deliver to us, but legends in essence, a mythology about our past and about our present that needs to be dispelled. He's author of the new book, Atheist Delusions, The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies, when we come back from this break. So if faith and reason are not old enemies, one which has triumphed, that is reason, then how should we rightly understand the life of the church intertwined with the life of civilization, with the rise of scientific inquiry, with the rise of all the technology that surrounds us now that makes us at least think that we're more enlightened than people of the past? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. More with Dr. David Bentley Hart after this.
My biggest fear is that this is not the work of the devil, because there can be no devil if there is no God. And if there were a God, he would never allow such suffering.
Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Click promote and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Would you like to post your favorite Issues Etc. audio segments on your website or blog? Well, we've made it easy for you. Just go to the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the embed green logo, and copy and paste the embed code on your website or blog. It's just like posting a YouTube video. Embed Issues Etc. audio on your website or blog today. We love our on-demand listeners. Old theology, new technology. Issuesetc.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the importance of Issues Etc.
Before settling in England and France, I had my own Christian radio program for 10 years in California and 2 years in Washington State. I was also a regular for over a decade on national religious television. In a word, I have had a great deal of contact with evangelical programming, both good and bad, and my judgment in this area is probably worth something. In my opinion, Issues Etc. is one of the very few programs on Christian radio willing to discuss tough questions with solid theological answers. I consider it a great privilege to be able to appear on the program regularly, and I commend it to every serious listener.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Defending the faith, teaching the truth. Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the new atheists. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. David Bentley Hart is our guest, former professor of religion at Duke, the University of Virginia, and Providence College, author of the new book, Atheist Delusions, The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. You'll find information about Atheist Delusions at issuesetc.org. Click on demand. Dr. Hart, another kind of common thing I think that is taught all the way down to grade school now is that there was this golden era prior to the Christian era proper where the great minds, Aristotle, Plato, and the like, formulated, were free thinkers, kind of an idealistic era there. Then comes Christianity that either wittingly or unwittingly kind of imposes a martial law over the mind. And then later, about 1,000 years later, by bootstrapping the old pagan masters, we kind of regain our right to think. What is the proper role of great minds, no doubt, in the pagan era? What's the proper relationship between that and Christian thought as it emerged in civilization?
Well, it's a blank characterization would be too general, but let's just look at that story for a moment. Part of it is tied to the notion that there was such a thing as a free-ranging culture of scientific inquiry. It was part of pagan philosophical tradition, which Christianity then rather maliciously suppressed in order to increase its power over the herd or its social cachet. The truth is that, again, this is a story that was fabricated in the late modern period, but that bears no relation to actual history. There's no scientific method in the sense that we understand that word today in pagan antiquity. Such as it was, Hellenistic science had a few accomplishments to boast, but it was a tradition that always tended towards stagnation for any number of intellectual or social or philosophical reasons. The sort of tradition of scientific inquiry, of empiricism and experiment and collection of data and that sort of thing that we today call science is something that emerges in late medieval culture among Christian schoolmen. The relationship between pagan philosophy and Christian philosophy is one of occasional friction, but mostly a sort of painless harmony that resulted in rather remarkable, again, stagnant, but usually rather remarkable and dynamic flows of ideas. And frankly, today, we don't have any culture of free inquiry that could really match that of the medieval universities. I think it's remarkable how little understanding we have of just how open and free and vibrant the intellectual culture of the great universities from the 13th century onward was. Today, as an occasional denizen of the academic world, I can tell you that ideas are not often as freely discussed, just for political pressures, as they were then, and certainly the freedom of scientific inquiry and theory in the Middle Ages was really quite extraordinary.
To be fair, let's also talk about, and you talk about this later in your book, the failure of the church to do really what it's what it could have done. You talk about translating total humanism, your term, into by way of influence into society. How did the church fall short?
So many ways I couldn't possibly enumerate them in one day. The book is not an apologetic for the institutional history of Christianity. I think it's clear that for all the benefits to Western civilization that came as a result of the conversion of the Roman Empire to Christianity, and just quite practical benefits. I'm not talking about anything else. And also the benefits in moral imagination fostered by constant immersion in the language of the Gospels. At the end of the day, I think we all know that the Church of the Empire, the Church of various kings, did function as an agent of social order rather than of Christian, which maybe Christian disorder at times. You know, though the pictures of say, evil inquisitors burning people at the stakes are exaggerations and tend to be vaguely understood at best, nonetheless, you know, the church did produce inquisitors. It did use terror. It did become a stable pillar of unjust regimes and of enfranchised social classes. As a whole, I have no brief to make on behalf of organized religion in the abstract, and so I freely grant the historical failures of the Christian churches, as long as I'm also allowed freely to make note of the historical failures of the secular culture that emerged from early modernity as well.
The new atheists will assert, this is one of their kind of their trump cards that they'll lay on the table as often as they can, that religion has a long history, and Christianity in particular, a long history of violence. Mm-hmm. And early in your book, you say, well, let's concede that religion can and often does lead to violence. What are you saying there?
Well, it's a general truth, and general truths are only vacuously true. It also leads to peace. I mean, there's no such thing as religion as such. There's no object out there, religion, that does this or does that. Religion and irreligion alike, if you examine their histories, have been used as justifications for and have prompted violence or justice. Intellectual stagnation or intellectual energy and innovation. I mean, it's just silly to look at the history of something called religion as though an Aztec priest sacrificing someone to the sun god Tenatiu and a Franciscan or a Buddhist monk ministering to the needs of a sick person are somehow tied together in a single continuum and constitute a single object that you can hate or love with one action of the will or soul. Again, all such arguments, I think, can be treated as nonsense and should be by grown-ups.
Finally, then, in your research on this, and especially grappling with atheists new and old, have you encountered an atheist who appears to genuinely understand what it is they despise as Christianity and honestly deals with it?
You mean today or just in the whole history of atheist polemic?
More recently, Dr.
Well, more recently. It's hard to say. I mean, I'm a great admirer, as you've read the book, so you know, a great admirer of Nietzsche, precisely because he's an unblinkered enemy of Christianity. That is, he really does understand the difference of Christianity from the pagan culture it broke from. And as a result, he doesn't deceive himself that he can reject Christianity and yet still cling to certain moral values. And he understands the difficulty and the danger that comes about with the loss of faith. And but Nietzsche's brilliant. Among modern atheists, those that publish, no, I don't think so. I can't really think of anyone off the top of my head. I've met personally atheists who seem to me to have very good, concrete, ethical reasons for unbelief, reasons that have to do with suffering, the suffering of children, historical injustices, the churches, things like that, which I do respect and I take quite seriously. And I say in the book, and really mean, that there are forms of unbelief that I regard as being much more admirable than certain forms of belief. But the level of atheist discourse right now is just depressingly low, because it's the work of men who are simply not educated enough, aren't philosophically trained well enough, are not reflective enough, are not interested enough in what they're talking about, really, to provide anything worth grappling with. And that's the depressing aspect of this, is the new atheists are such a decline from the old atheists who are worth reading.
Dr. David Bentley Hart is former professor of religion at Duke, the University of Virginia, and Providence College. His new book, Atheist Delusions, The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. Dr. Hart, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, deal with an honest atheist. And you do have to go back quite a ways in order to find one who not only knows the subject which they are criticizing, generally Christianity, and doesn't generalize all the way out into every religion, but actually can honestly deal with it. And I agree. I think in some cases it's better to have an honest atheist than a dishonest anything else, religious or irreligious. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.